Hello, everyone. I'm Nate Truax, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the CrocCast Podcast. I'm your host, Nate. And today, I'm joined by Mr. Warren R. Schmidt, the Research Director at Biodiversity Nature and Biodiversity and Environment of Africa. Warren, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nate. Thank you. Really excited to be here and finally meet you in person.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So you want to get started off on how you first got into herps?
Yeah, so it dates back probably, I wouldn't say half a century. I won't give away my age that far back. But yeah, around about the 1980s, mid-1980s and that, we moved to a small holding in the south of Johannesburg. As I was born in Johannesburg in South Africa around about 73. And moving to the small holding, I suddenly came across a couple of snakes out in the field. And at first, they terrified the daylights out of me because I had no understanding. You know, are these things dangerous? You get passed down a lot of fear that is brought down via your parents or people that you associate with. And you just get this instinctive fear of a snake. But shortly after moving onto the farm, got hold of a rhombic egg eater, a completely harmless South African colubrid that feeds exclusively on bird eggs. And the moment I picked this snake up and it was moving through my fingers and my hands, I thought to myself, why are people so afraid of these things? It was absolutely fascinating. And to see that little forked tongue coming in and out, I had so many questions. And of course, you start off, you get your first book, you start reading, you start interacting with the community, and you start getting to know other people that keep snakes. And that fascination just began to grow over the years. And from there, when I was still in high school, around about the early 1990s, I was fortunate enough to join over weekends while I was still in high school. I joined the Transvaal Snake Park in Halfway House in Midrand. It's just on the outskirts of Johannesburg. And Transvaal Snake Park was founded by a guy by the name of Bernie Cater, originally as a facility to do venom extraction for the production of antivenom. And later on, that was around about... No, you still there, Nate?
Yeah.
Ah. Yeah, just disappeared there slightly. And later on, a guy by the name of Rod Patterson took over from Bernie Cater, and he built an incredible terrarium, a very large indoor terrarium, which housed probably about 120 exhibits. And I started working there over weekends. At first, I couldn't work with anything hot. I couldn't handle any of the venomous stuff, but I got to start doing Python demonstrations on the weekend and engaging with the public and giving little displays. And as soon as I finished high school, I joined Transvaal Snake Park as an assistant curator. And I spent the better part of about 5 or 7 years at the snake park.
Sorry, I've lost. And after that, sorry about that. And after that, what led you up to where you are now?
Right. So after Transvaal Snake Park, having spent quite a few years there and really getting to know reptile husbandry, we kept a wide range of species. I mean, a lot of them are really common now in the trade, but initially we were keeping and breeding things like Madagascan ground boas, Angolan dwarf pythons, and a lot of stuff that just wasn't available in large quantities anywhere in the trade. Now, of course, you know, you can go online and you can get Angolan dwarf pythons, a range of Madagascan boas, and all sorts of things. So I learned a lot at the snake park, and I started breeding and keeping snakes myself as a hobby. Had quite a large collection of North American colubrids, the king snakes, the rat snakes, a couple of Asian rat snakes. Those were my favorites. I never really kept any of the big pythons and that, although I did at one time have a really good collection of Burmese pythons. And so I started playing around and breeding various snakes as a hobby and that. And run about 1997, an opportunity came up at a crocodile farm, not too far from Johannesburg, probably about, I'd say, 120 miles out of Johannesburg in a place called Sun City, which is on the border of Pilanesberg Game Reserve. And it was something different. I'd never thought about croc farming before, and I was given the opportunity. So I went out to what was then called Koyana Gardens Crocodile Farm. That crocodile farm is subsequently closed, I think probably about 10 years back now. And we had a collection of around about 2,000 Nile crocodiles. Our largest one was one called Arnold that was just under 5 meters, but probably weighing close to 1,000 kilograms. And he was, he just had character. If you got too close to him, I have no doubt he would have grabbed you, pulled you into the pond and just considered you protein. He was quite a challenge. And then we had another crocodile there called Footloose. And Footloose was missing one foot through a previous encounter with fighting with one of the males. And Footloose had a totally different temperament. If on a good day, you could literally sit on his back, and he measured from the tip of the snout to the tip of the tail, he was exactly 5 meters long. And so also quite capable of eating you, but he was mellow. And so I enjoyed that, and I learned a lot about crocodiles. One of the most fascinating things, and I'm sure you probably have it with alligators as well, but I learned that crocodiles are super intelligent. They get to know you. They get to identify you. And I'm pretty sure captive crocs as well have the same ability to recognize their owners and react differently to different people. And I picked that up on a number of occasions. One example, we had, obviously, with all the female crocodiles breeding and that, we would go in and physically remove the eggs and incubate them in the artificial incubator. And there was one particular female that obviously took huge offense to me taking her eggs. And we used to use a 50 millimeter PVC water pipe to sort of gently knock them on the head to chase them off the nest. And occasionally these females would bite that pipe and whip it around in their jaws. And if that whacked you, you felt it. It gave you a really good whipping. And this particular female, I mean, out of the 30 or 40 females that were laying eggs, she was the only one that would, after that, every time I got into the enclosure, she would get out the water and chase me around the enclosure. And I had to watch myself. And yet anybody else climbed in there to do maintenance work, she ignored them completely. If I got in there, she came after me. So you learn these little characteristics about crocodiles, and I can understand why they become such dangerous predators in like the saltwater croc in Australia and these places. They just learn human habits so well, and they can calculate when people are coming down to water, when they are taking risks, and it's no surprise that they're just such superb, efficient predators.
Yeah, speaking on the American alligators and reacting differently to different people, I've noticed that in different internships I've done with alligators, they do react very different. And each individual has their own unique personality, and they also react very differently to different people they know. So, example, one really big alligator I worked with, the one owner of the place is basically his lap dog. He'll come up and just sit there with him all day if he wanted to. Whereas if the other owner came in, he'd either A, go back to the back of the pond, dive down into his den and hide the rest of the day, or B, try and kill him. So they do, I can firmly say that at least alligators can easily recognize different people and definitely have different opinions about different people.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah. No, it's quite fascinating. And yet, when you look at the size of a crocodilian brain, it's literally the size of a golf ball, on an adult. And yet, they have these remarkable abilities. And when you watch their social behavior as well, particularly in the breeding season, and very similar to the alligators, the Nile crocodiles have a similar kind of display where the male swims with his back arced out of the water, raised quite high. And then he will do this vibrational shake in the water. And it's incredible to watch, especially early in the morning when you've got that condensation rising up off the water, giving it a almost like Jurassic steamy effect. And you see these crocodiles ripple in the water, and then they do that low grumble. And you see how all the females in the surrounding pond react to that. And as he swims up to them, or they come across him, how they lift their jaws up in submission. And you watch all this intricate behavior, which I suppose you get it in certain lizard species. You might see certain displays in that, but it seems really refined in the crocodilians. And that gave me a lot of respect for them on an individual basis. So I was at Sun City at Quena Gardens Crocodile Farm for just over 2 years. And eventually, the commercial side of crocodile farming kind of got to me because it was a commercial enterprise where we would kill the crocodiles for their skins. We were trading a lot of skins at the time with Italy and Japan. And being a reptile lover and just kind of having this appreciation, that side of the farming operation started to get to me after a while. And I really didn't enjoy the commercial side of crocodile farming, even though I understood the conservation benefits and how it alleviated pressure off the wild populations. And eventually, I kind of decided to move on, and I went into the world of journalism, of all things. I kind of turned away. I always kept my interest in herpetology. But from around about 2000 up until probably 2015, I worked as a journalist and magazine editor. And then I went back into environmental consulting, working on invasive species, herpetology, ecological impact studies. And subsequently, I'm currently at the moment living in Portugal. I relocated to Portugal with my family and my wife and daughter, about going close on to a year and a half ago now. And but I've still got I'm still doing a lot of work across Africa.
So was that work primarily with the biodiversity organization you have in your profile?
So we're working on a number of ideas at the moment. Biodiversity and Environment Africa came about around about 2009. I got a new digital camera and I just started photographing everything. Before, I used to photograph on a couple of other digital cameras, and prior to that, doing 35 millimeter slide transparency. And when you're doing slides, you're restricted to how much you can photograph. So I used to really just focus on certain snakes and reptiles and that. But when I went digital, it was all out. I started photographing spiders, scorpions, mammals, birds, various plants, you name it. And I got this idea to just start documenting all sorts of biodiversity and landscapes as well across much of Southern Africa. And if you look at the rate of habitat transformation and how things are changing, I just started this off as a project where everything I photographed, I would take GPS coordinates and the date and time and started putting together databases. So I've built up this massive repository of something like 70,000 digital images of all sorts of things. Naturally, amphibians and reptiles are still my primary interest. So I spend a lot of time focusing on that group. And I'm particularly interested in the distribution and biogeography of African snakes. I think if you look at how things have progressed taxonomically over the past decade or so, and especially with looking at genetic sequencing and all the statistical analysis that has gone behind that, where we now have a much clearer understanding of snake relationships and taxonomy. I think we're now at a point where we can really start looking at distributions and conservation, because, you know, at one time, I mean, we just certain snakes like the good old common brown house snake, the Boedon genus. At one time, there were two or three species, a very widespread snake, just simply called the brown house snake. And just recently, I saw there's a paper that came out now in 2025 where there's another two species that have been described from Ethiopia and Somalia. So we're getting to understand the species better. And now it's such a good time to start understanding the distribution. So I'm spending a lot of time mapping and plotting distributions. And I'm also really interested in looking how those distributions have changed over time, from historical distributions to now, against the background of habitat change and global climate change and all of that transformation. So that's a project I'm going to be busy with, hopefully for the next decade at least.
Okay. And what has been your favorite species to work on with this project?
That's a really good point. Traditionally, I've always really love the family or the subfamily, the Lamprophidae, or some people consider it a subfamily of the greater Lamprophids. And those include your water snakes and your house snakes, your file snakes, all the smaller non-venomous constrictors, which I find quite fascinating in that. And it's in contrast to what a lot of people go for. You know, everybody else is doing the big adders and the vipers or the mumbas and the cobras. Yeah. You know, but I've kind of always appreciated the little underdogs of the reptile world. But nonetheless, snake bite is a really serious issue across much of Africa. So I'm also really interested in nealepids and the adders and the vipers, and also quite fascinated by some of these big vipers that are coming out of like Ethiopia, where it gives one sort of hope that there's still undescribed species sitting in different parts of Africa. I think it was only the 1970s that the Ethiopian mountain viper, Bitis parviocula, was described, and then more recently, Bitis harina from the Harina Mountains and forest in Ethiopia. And those are areas that are relatively well explored. You know, the people have been through there over decades and yet missed identifying these. So I think there's quite a few surprises in Africa still. But yeah, my feelings on which is my favorite species, it kind of changes over time. You know, I kind of go through like fashion trends where suddenly you get really interested in a group of water snakes, and then you, a bit later, you really kind of get interested in mumbas and you want to know, you know, where are the sort of distribution boundaries of the different mumbas. And so, yeah, it changes.
Yeah. I had actually recently gotten The Snake of Southern Africa by Johan Murray. And yeah, I just been skimming through it most of the most part, but it's really been sparking my interest and one desire to go to South Africa and Namibia to do some herping trip sometime in the next few years.
Well, I reckon we must team up for that, and we must do an awesome herping trip around those parts of Africa. And Namibia is just an incredible country. You know, there's so many endemics, the Namib Desert, and what Namibia has to offer in terms of herping is incredible. But if you had to ask me, I think every country in Africa offers something unique. South Africa's got an incredible diversity. They've got a very active herp community, both field herpers and people that are keeping reptiles as a hobby. It's quite big in South Africa. And Yeah, if you go up north, Mozambique is quite spectacular. There's a lot of new things popping out of Mozambique, as well as Angola as well. Those are two countries that have spent in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s up until the early 2000s were in states of civil war. So much of that land has yet to be explored, and there's little remnants of and little pockets of forests where there's some really nice things hiding out in those forests and that. We just got to hope that, you know, they can hold off the habitat destruction until we can actually get around there and see what really is sitting in those forests.
I was going to say, there's some background noise that might be happening here, so I've been kind of muting my mic when I'm not talking.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting that I have it muted. So, sorry, folks at home, but there's these long, awkward pauses. It's not that we don't like each other. It's that I have the mic muted. But I was going to say, it makes most sense that the places in Africa that have the most undiscovered or cryptic species would be like these very difficult to access habitats that are also historically the past half century or so been politically unstable, I guess is a polite way of putting it.
Yeah.
So there's one thing researchers don't like is going to a place where you might get shot. So
yeah. And you know, Africa's an interesting place. I spent the better part of a century in South Africa, and we've got some issues with violent crime and that. And if you had to ask me honestly, I'd say that pretty much most of Africa is probably safer than South Africa in terms of traveling around. But yeah, there's a lot of social disparity in different countries. I mean, if you go onto Google Earth and you go over the Democratic Republic of Congo, you just see carpets of green, like just thousands and thousands of miles of forest. But if you go to sort of the northeastern parts of the DRC, there's a lot of civil conflict going on there. And for reptile people, scientists, biologists to go into some of these places, it does come with a fair amount of risk. So you really do need to know where you're going. But there's a lot of really good countries you can still explore. Malawi is fantastic, really friendly people, but a lot of people in Malawi. Namibia is great, very safe country to travel around. Tanzania, Kenya, there's actually a lot of local guys that are offering specialized herping tours in Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania. So, and those are becoming quite popular and relatively safe countries to move about in. I'm not that familiar with the West African countries. I know there's been a few issues with ISIS in some of the sort of sub-Saharan, just kind of south of the Sahara.
The Sahel places.
Yeah, places like Benin and Central African Republic, and that there's a couple of areas. So not many people go there. It's usually like the aid agencies and stuff, but still quite a bit of work coming up by the French guys that are doing research in those areas. But yeah, you've just got to do your homework. I think that's the bottom line. You know, wherever you travel, you just find out from the locals how things are. And ideally team up with the local people that know the territory and know where to go and where safe to herp.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have a friend of mine who, he grew up as a missionary kid in West Africa. It wasn't Sierra Leone, I think. It was another country. But he mentioned how there's a lot of environmental degradation in those countries, it seems like. So
yeah.
Maybe find a safe country in Western Africa to visit and visit what you can in case things aren't there any longer. And to be honest, Central and West Africa has some of the highest croc diversity of any place on the earth. We have 2-3 species of Osteolamus, 2 species of Mesostops, the West African crocodile, Sucus. So,
yeah.
Greater West Africa, Central Africa region, that's like, what, 6 species of crocodilian?
Yeah, Yeah. And what's interesting about the crocodiles up north as well is I've always been quite fascinated with these relic populations that you get in parts of the Sahara, where, yeah, it would be crocodiles.
Yeah, the ones that are like in those really old oases.
Yeah, in those. And I mean, those are really unique territories to explore in that. And I've been looking, at the moment I'm working on a distribution map for the four species of pythons in Africa, and I've been quite intrigued as to the distribution of the most of the literature calls it the Northern African python, Python Sebae. I kind of prefer Central African python because it's more a Central African species, but I've been really interested in how many records are coming from really arid desert areas, which are also probably around little oases in these desert environments. And historically, even just going back 2,000-3,000 years ago, there was a lot more rainfall going up into North Africa and what is now the Sahel area. So it was a lot more tropical and a lot more wet. And so I'm kind of really curious as to how far north these pythons actually went in historical times. And if you look at ancient Roman and Greek statues and mosaics and that, they feature a lot of pythons in their artwork and some of their sculptures. And I know that the Greeks and that, and the Romans at one time did a few expeditions down towards like Ethiopia in that time, I think they called it Abyssinia. And sort of touching on the northern parts of the Sudan and those areas. So they would have brought back a lot of stories and imagery about, you know, python encounters. But one wonders historically how far north they went up like the Nile River Valley and if pythons ever did occur in Egypt. So I'm like looking at this and I'm finding it quite fascinating in mixing that ancient Greek and Roman mythology and putting it down to, you know, historical and current day python distributions, again, in the backdrop of climate change, not only just the man-made climate change, but the sort of interglacial cycles, you know, that take place over thousands of years, and you've got this contraction and expansion of forest and savanna.
I was about to say, maybe it's curious to see how far they might have gone up the Nile Valley, but considering how long the valley, Nile Valley's been developed by humans, it wouldn't be surprised me if they historically did get pretty far up, but have been gone there from there for thousands of years.
Yes, yeah.
But I was also going to say, West African crocodiles, we find that mummies of them in Egypt, even though they historically didn't live in Egypt, it's speculated that maybe Egyptians imported them into Egypt because they're easier to work with than Niles.
Yeah.
So maybe there was a bit of a trade with exotic animals in Egypt that might have involved pythons. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm convinced of that. And I've never really been crazy about history. I mean, when we did history in school, it was I kind of winged it. But now I've kind of, you know, you start looking back and you merge your interest in biodiversity and herpetology, and you start going back into, you know, literature dating back 2,000-3,000 years and what the Romans were trying to figure out. And it really is quite fascinating. And I mean, crocodiles just play such a huge part in human culture. It's all over the Egyptian hieroglyphs, and you see the imagery of crocodiles and things, and it's so deeply entrenched in different cultures and that. So I see your interest is quite a bit on the crocodilian side as well.
Well, the podcast is named the Croccast podcast. So.
Yeah.
A bit of a giveaway, I'll say.
Yeah.
But speaking of African pythons, you mentioned you've bred Angolans. I'm guessing you mentioned you didn't really work with the big species. I'm guessing you didn't work with the Natalensis, but I didn't work with balls or royal pythons, Regius.
Yes, yeah. So when I was at the snake park, we actually had all four of the African python species, plus Burmese pythons. We had a green anaconda as well, but we never bred the green anacondas. Yellow anacondas became really popular in the pet trade in the 1990s. There are a lot of people breeding them, but it's quite an irascible species. So it wasn't really that popular, kind of your diehard still keep yellow anacondas, I think. And we were breeding Cuban ground boas as well. It's one of the only pythons I've been bitten by where the juvenile was still in the amniotic sac, where it was still literally being born. And I picked this thing up and it bit me through the membrane. it's like they're just such cheeky animals. I mean, I've never known anything like that. And we used to breed the Southern African pythons, Nyctalensis, quite often, and the Burmese pythons as well. From time to time, we would breed those.
So how does Nyctalensis differ from Cebe?
It's quite interesting. It's something I'm looking at as well now on iNaturalist and the GBIF database. I've just noticed on iNaturalist, I was on that platform yesterday, and there's quite a few misidentifications from the northern parts of Tanzania and southern Kenya, because the two species have got a really interesting distribution in East Africa, where Cebe is more of a lowland tropical forest species, and you also find it along the eastern coastal areas from Somalia going down along the Kenya coast into northern Tanzania, and kind of moving a little bit up in altitude into the Usambara and Uluguru mountains in Tanzania. But then the Nyctalensis is more of a savanna species and seems to prefer slightly higher altitudes. And I've noticed that there looks like there's quite a few misidentifications between the two species in northern Tanzania. So it's something I'm looking at the moment. But if you had a look at them side by side, Cebe almost looks very much like a Burmese python. They've got a much richer, more prominent bold markings than what Nyctalensis has. More of like, if I can describe it, as a rich golden brown, which reminds me a bit of a Burmese python, whereas Southern African pythons, Nyctalensis, are more on the gray side, and their patterning is not as prominent. But you'd have to look at them side by side to kind of see what I mean, because they do look very similar. And then apparently it's really got to do with the ornamentation of the head shields, with Cebe having more prominent or larger scales on top of the head, and Nyctalensis having smaller scales that are kind of more evenly spaced over much of the head and that. But
a bit more pebbly?
Yeah. But there's no doubt that the two species are incredibly closely related. And I'm sure in some parts there may be hybridization occurring between the two populations. But they, so far from what I can work out on my distribution maps, there definitely does seem to be segregation between the two species. They don't seem to come in contact very much. So it's quite interesting in that. And how I'm putting these maps together is I'm utilizing a whole range of different references. So from actual museum material through to literature records, and then GBIF and iNaturalist and my own database and that, and just merging them all. But the biggest thing is really just spending time to try and confirm the species identity. Because when you've got like pythons from West Africa, it's pretty straightforward. You know that it's either going to be Regius or Cebe. And they're the two you can tell apart instantly. Yeah. But then when you get to like Tanzania and Kenya and you've got, you know, an overlap, you've got to start looking at the species more clearly. And sometimes the photographs are not that clear. You know, they've been taken from a distance and it gets a little bit tricky.
Yeah. So I was going to say, I've never worked with either CBE or Natalensis. However, I've heard the stereotypes surrounding CBE in terms of just being a really difficult species to work with in terms of their personality. Like I said, I've never worked with them, so I can't say anything to whether it's true or not. I was wondering if you can shed light on if they're as ill-tempered as the stereotypes lead me to believe.
That's an interesting thing. I must tell you a funny story related to that. But in my experience, both CBE and Natalensis, you have both individuals in that group. You've got some that do become quite tractable. You can put them around your neck and you can handle them like you would a Burmese python. They do tame down, but there are a few individuals that do have that nasty nature to them. And no matter how many times you try to handle them, or even from when they're quite young, they've just got, what I'd call the Cuban Grumbo personality. They just won't calm down. But I've had both. I've worked with pythons, Southern African pythons that, like I say, exactly like a Burmese python, it would never, attempt to bite or anything like that. But having said that, the two worst python bites I've ever experienced were both from Burmese, and they were both feeding accidents. So there was some error in judgment. At Transvaal Snake Park, one of the scariest accidents I had, we used to have these raised ledges on the side of the vivarium. So it was a large walk-in enclosure, and we had four Burmese pythons in there, plus a green anaconda, which would always be in the water pond. But I went in and I was feeding dead rodents. At that time, I think it was probably rabbits or guinea pigs. And I had fed one of the pythons on the ledge, which was probably about 2 meters high, probably just nearly as high, as tall as I am. And I went out to get the next rabbit. And when I came back in, I didn't realize that that python had let go of its food. So I walked underneath the ledge. And next thing, I felt this solid whack right on the back of my neck, both jaws coming on either side of my neck. And I just felt these rows of teeth embed into my neck. And of course, this was a feeding bite. So that python wanted to kill. And it grabbed, and I just grabbed its head and made sure it couldn't get a coil around my neck. I didn't want to become a statistic. And
you didn't want to make headlines that day.
Yeah, I didn't want to be on world news, of another guy killed by his Burmese python or something. And it was a bit of a concern, because the second big mistake I made that day, I was alone. There was nobody else feeding. And it's one thing, you kind of hear the stories, you learn about working with big constrictors and that, but it's a pure example of complacency. You get complacent with the animals. You think you know them. You're kind of using a bit of your intuition. You go, well, I've just fed that one. It's busy swallowing its food now. But it just goes to show how quick an accident can happen. And you've got to go in and you've got to say to yourself, let me just double check. It's like a loaded gun. Or if you're on a firing range, just check your firearm and make sure there's no bullet in the chamber. It's the same as feeding pythons. And what I managed to do is obviously with those sharp recurved teeth embedded in your neck, I had to push the python's jaw more in and literally get my fingers inside of the mouth. And then, of course, I had the fingers penetrating the teeth penetrating my fingers, and I managed to work its jaw off and got out. But you can imagine how a neck wound bleeds when you've got about 30 or 40 puncture holes in your neck. It looked like I just survived an attack by a tiger shark or a great white shark. So that was probably my worst python bite. I mean, I'd never experienced anything like that from Southern African pythons or anything. And then, of course, my second serious bite was to the arm, and it was also a feeding bite by a Burmese python. So I've learned my lesson through and through with those big guys. And I mean, you're talking, those Burmese pythons at the time are probably about 3.5 to 4.5 meters. They were big pythons. I'm not sure how that translates into feet, but
about say 11 to 13, 14 foot.
Yeah. No, they're big snakes.
So, yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, Burmese are just usually so lax, they kind of lull you into a false sense of security about them.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and you're always taking them out. We used to use them a lot for Python demonstrations with the public, and I kind of had a lot of trust in them, you know. So outside of feeding, they really gentle giants. But I think most of the fatalities on keepers have been feeding accidents. If you read all the case histories, it's really just when they smell food, they go into hunting mode, and you've just got to watch your back.
Yeah, I had a former professor of mine who I won't name him on air because I don't know if he wants to tell us to name on the story or not. But he told me he had some Burmese pythons that were originally actually captured from the Everglades and he kept them on a research permit or something like that. But he had these pythons, but his side business at home, he breeds dogs. Well, he had to go do a demonstration with one of these Burmese pythons and he had to stop home. Do something so his vest smelled like his dog's, and he's out on the table with his Burmese python. Also, I noticed the Burmese start head jerking side to side, tongue flicking out really rapidly. He's like, "Uh-oh, this is about to go bad."
Yeah.
And it just fortunately just grabbed his vest and wrapped part of his a knot on his vest. And it's like, okay, and basically spent the rest of the day with kids coming up petting while it was trying to squeeze the death out of his jacket. So.
Yeah. No, it kind of, puts things into perspective on that. And I've kind of, when you work with reptiles over a long period of time and that, accidents happen, and like I say, I think we are all guilty of complacency at some point in time. Even working with venomous, you're working with mambas on a daily basis. You get used to them. You get used to their personality, how they react, and unfortunately, it's at times like that where you just have one split second of misjudgment, and you're in trouble. I've only fortunately in my entire career, I've only had one venomous snake bite, and that was by a Cape cobra. Not exactly the best snake to choose, but that was also absolutely.
The one hit you got, it was a home run, so.
Yeah, that was also complete stupidity on my behalf. I was showing off, I was still young, single at the time, and you have two beautiful girls coming to the snake park, and they ask you, what's that crawling around there? It's like, well, that's a Cape cobra. Instead of just pointing to it, you've got to neck the snake and show them the fangs. And whilst doing that, just a little lapse of concentration, and before I knew it, the snake had latched onto my finger, one fang penetrating, and it was enough to put in a bit of venom into my system. And of all the snakes, I mean, mambas and your bigger leopards, like your cobras and taipans, those are the kind of things you really don't want to get bitten by. Really strong, potent neurotoxin, and it's absorbed quite rapidly into the mammalian body. Our sort of endothermic body just, it takes it, sucks up that venom. It's like, give it to me.
Kind of engineered
And
for it.
yeah, and within probably about 30 minutes, I could actually feel my system shutting down. I could feel the muscular part of me, my leg muscles and that just weren't reacting the way they should, and you're in trouble. Fortunately, I was airlifted by helicopter to one of the local medical facilities, and they started putting in the antivenom probably within an hour of the bite. And I think, if memory serves me correct, I got about 80 mils or 8 vials of antivenom to treat that bite. And I managed to avoid going into respiratory distress or respiratory failure. So I was on oxygen and that, but I didn't need any life support
You didn't need to
intervention.
be
So
intubated or anything like that.
no, I got off lightly with that. But again, you just, and all I can say, especially to the younger generation of keepers out there, like, don't take chances. It's really easy to do. You become complacent in that. And I always, when I hear of people getting bitten now by something venomous and that, you shrug your shoulders and you just hope for the best outcome for them. And, but I used to do crazy things all the time. you know.
Yeah, so
these days I'm a lot more cautious. I'm even cautious of mildly venomous snakes. I don't like to take any risks with I just don't know how my body's going to react to even a mild venom, you know, with anaphylaxis or something like that. So I don't take chances. And the same when I worked in the crocodile farm, you also, you know, you start taking a few chances around the crocodiles. But these days, if I'm in croc territory, I look at that water and I don't go near
it.
They
10 feet back, at least.
Yeah, yeah. I know what those crocodiles are capable of. I still want to try and get through another 30, 40 years if I can.
Yeah. I was going to say, being bit by a big croc, you know, a snake, if you get on any of them, like you say, you might get off lightly. A big croc gets you, best case scenario, is like your hand popping off. So
yeah, yeah. And, you know, to me, a venomous snake bite like a neurotoxin is not the worst possible way to go. But, you know, it's almost like a sedative in a way, maybe not as tranquil.
Yeah.
But being taken
a viper, on the other hand,
yeah, being pulled into the water and going through that death roll where it's like tearing you from limb to limb, and that's not a cool way to go. That's quite terrifying. And on the
it's
crocodile
like drowning and being eaten at the same time. So
yeah, yeah. I mean, I was bitten a few times by really small crocodiles. I think the largest one that got me was probably about just over a half a meter or so, and the strength of that jaw, I had one little hatchling that was probably about a couple of months old as well. We were doing some maintenance work in one of the ponds, and I was clearing out some overgrown brush and reeds that was growing in the water. And what I didn't see, there was a little juvenile crocodile inside the reeds. And when I put my finger down, it grabbed me and bit me right through the fingernail. And that was painful. That hurt.
And anything through a fingernail, just
yeah. And I thought, if that's what a little hatchling crocodile can do, one of those 5 meter crocodiles, if they grab you, it's gonna be like, you know, multiply the pain and the fear factor by 50. I think you kind of get to know that. Yeah
But like you said, a lap is kind of like almost a sedative. Whereas, from what I know, it sounds like, you know, bitis, so like especially puff adders, is almost like you just rot to death. So,
yeah.
A lot worse way to go.
Yeah. I had one colleague who was bitten by a puff adder while I was at the snake park. And if I had no option but to choose between the two, I would have gone the Cape Cobra route, because, you know, after the antivenom and 2 or 3 days of recovery, you kind of get back into it. Whereas he had a physical disability on his hand. He was bitten on the hand. And what the doctors did at the time, it's quite a controversial procedure, but they did a fasciotomy. And it took several months for him to gain use of his hand again and for that tissue to heal. Whereas my recovery was a few days, and yeah, it took me probably a month or two. I still would get really tired and out of energy. Whether or not that was from the antivenom treatment or the bite itself, I'm not sure. But a cytotoxic bite is a whole different story. You know, it's just if it's really serious and you can have that physical disability and muscular damage that could leave you disfigured for life, with your rattlesnakes and puff adders. And so, yeah, cytotoxic bites are definitely not fun.
Yeah. With that being said, I think vipers are better looking than most lapids, but I digress.
Yeah.
That being said, I would really love to photograph a zebra cobra someday.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They're absolutely stunning in that. I've actually got quite a fondness. I mean, you're talking earlier about my favorite snakes. I kind of enjoy the spitting cobras, that whole group. I think when I worked on the crocodile farm, funny enough, at Sun City, we had so many Mozambique spitting cobras in the vicinity because they feed primarily on toads and frogs. and we had a lot of water with the croc ponds, and most of the enclosures were built from rock. So they were rock walls with a lot of crevices inside of the wall. So perfect refuge for these spinning cobras. And on one or two days during summer, you could come across two or three spinning cobras during the day. But they were never aggressive. If you approach them, they would just go straight back into the hole, or they would retreat into the underbrush and disappear. And they were never really a problem. Despite them being like really common. But yeah, the spinning cobras are something interesting. And of course, when you grab them or you try to catch them to relocate them, that's when they do turn around, and they can be quite accurate with that venom if they need to be.
Yeah. So I was going to say, if I ever do a herbivore trip to South Africa, I'm definitely packing my pro. So
yeah. Yeah.
So have you done much work research wise with any of the vipers, the bittis in Africa?
Not much. It's something I'd really like to look at again. I'm hoping sometime this year, if all goes well, I'm planning a trip to Ethiopia to try and see what the status of the endemic Ethiopian vipers are, to see what the, you know, firsthand what the habitat looks like. If you read the literature, there's contradictory accounts as to whether the species live in actual primary forest or if they live in grassland areas or kind of a mixed savanna forest mosaic. So I'd like to look at those a bit more. Back in South Africa, I came across a lot of puff adders. Funny enough, most of them on the road, a lot of them were roadkills, and probably the same when you're in the States and you see rattlesnakes and that, a lot of them are roadkill. When you're actually looking for a puff adder in the wilderness, and you can spend days and days and days, and they're there, you know, they're in the habitat, you just don't see them. They are the most incredible snakes on how they can just blend into a little bit of vegetation, partially bury themselves in a bit of leaflet or something under a bush. And unless you physically got your hook stick and you're raking every part of those leaves, and I mean in a, you know, big piece of ground, you can spend a year doing that before you'll come across a puff adder just sitting there. And yeah, it's not so much like, I think when you do encounter a rattlesnake in the wild, a lot of the times they're going to rattle and let you know of their presence. Pose,
yeah.
Yeah. Whereas puff adders, they just keep dead still. It's only when they're disturbed and you touch them, well, they start their hissing and their puffing. But apart from that, they just remain absolutely still. You know, most of the ones that you see hissing and puffing and striking and carrying on, it's when they're caught out in the open and they've been exposed, and then they put on that big display. But when they're just sitting in an ambush position waiting for a rodent to come by, they keep perfectly still. Yeah. I think most of the adders do that. You know, a lot of the ambush predators, like horned adders, they all just kind of sit incredibly still until such a time that you touch them with something.
Yeah, I guess they just have a lot of faith in their camouflage.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And sometimes a little bit too much so. And I've also heard a lot of stories of people actually stepping on puff adders, on gaboon vipers, without having any reaction, with them just sitting perfectly still. So I think you've got to really be unlucky to get bitten by one of those.
Yeah, but the bites do happen. So if you do get bit, trying to get a medical attention pretty quick.
Yeah, yeah.
So you don't want your foot rotting off. So
yeah.
So you mentioned you really like the non-venomous, and just speaking as someone from who lives in the States, at least in popular herp media, you don't really see much of the non-venomous African snakes.
Yes.
Outside maybe house snakes and the pythons. So can you go do a brief run over some of the like South African non-venomous outside of house snakes and pythons?
Yeah, well, what's quite interesting about that comparison and that, and it's always fascinated me to some degree. If you look at a lot of your North American colubrids, like the pine snakes, the gopher snakes, the rat snakes, they're quite large snakes. So they're relatively easy to maintain in captivity because most of them will feed on rodents or birds. And they grow to, good 3 to 6 feet in length. Whereas a lot of the African colubrids and that are really small by comparison. And as such, they're a lot more difficult to maintain in captivity. And then a lot of them are specialized dietary specialists, like your egg-eating snakes.
Really fascinating. Stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the egg-eaters are quite interesting in my opinion. But if you've got an adult, they grow to maybe 80 centimeters, maybe a meter or so at the most. And then they're relatively easy to maintain. You can feed them poultry eggs and or quail eggs, and they'll be fine. But when you breed them, the hatchlings are a nightmare. I mean, you've got to get tiny little eggs to get them going. And it's not like if you breed out 24 corn snakes or something.
You just got to feed them pinkies, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Give them a couple of days for their first shed. And you get a few pinkies and, you can almost be guaranteed that all 24 are going to eat. You might just have one difficult one that just decides, no, he's going to be difficult. But when you have like egg eaters, even with the smallest of eggs, you might get a situation where none of them want to eat. And then you got to resort to force feeding and you can end up killing half of them because they're just so small and delicate. And that's kind of a thing you see with a lot of the African snakes, a lot of the non-venomous snakes. There's a couple of exceptions, like your African mole snake, which is probably as close to a pine or gopher snake as you get. They grow quite large. But unlike the pine and the gopher snakes, they're also not the easiest snake to keep in captivity. Some do well, and then others just refuse to feed. They just won't settle in captivity. So it makes keeping African colubrids and similar kind of snakes quite difficult. And I think that's why you don't really see them in the US or in Europe in the hobby so much, because it's just there's a couple of people that will keep them. Whereas your adders and the vipers, your gaboon vipers, your rhino vipers, the cobras and that are relatively large, and most of them will take to feeding on rodents without much problem. So they tend to be a lot more popular. And then some of the smaller leopards, like the coral snakes or the coral cobras, I think it's just because they're so brightly colored and, you know, people will keep them for that reason. So yeah, it's interesting in that. There's just so many African species as well that are specialists on frogs or amphibians or lizards, like the Phylothamnus green snakes. I don't know of anybody that keeps them. They just feed on, if you've got a good supply of amphibians or little frogs or geckos, you can probably keep them going. So you don't see much of that going into the trade.
Interesting. Another group of African snakes I'm interested in is the African garter snakes, which are actually lapids as opposed to the non-venomous North American flavor. Well,
yeah,
non-venomous, but I digress. I don't know much about them other than they're in a lapid, and they kind of look, honestly, they look a bit more like a coral snake to me than they do a garter snake, but have you had any experience working with them?
Yeah, very limited, though, because they are ultra secretive. We've got the taxonomy is actually quite confused. In South Africa, we've got one that they call the Sundervall's garter snake, and there's several subspecies within that group, but nobody's really looked at the genetics in any detail because they're really hard to come by. You don't see them that often. They're quite secretive. Usually living under large boulders and rocks in some habitats, a lot of the times in abandoned or deserted termite mounds, you'll get them in places like that. And they're also relatively small. So when people do come across them, it's not something that really, goes into the hobby. But there's one or two people that will be dedicated to trying to find out more about those snakes. I've come across probably in all my time, maybe three or four individuals, and they definitely not aggressive. As you come across them, they just keep trying to hide their head. Similar to, I think, your crates in Southeast Asia, where they've got this habit of, they just throw the coils over their head all the time to protect the head.
I was going to say, I was in Costa Rica a few months ago, and we saw some Costa Rican coral snakes, and they did the exact same thing, just flailing about, trying to distract you from where the head is.
Yeah. And similar to that, I know the crates and some of the coral snakes do bite quite a lot, but it takes a lot to get a garter snake to bite you. They've got relatively small mouths and that. And the venom, some of the bites have presented sort of neurological symptoms. Others have manifested in a bit of cytotoxic localized pain and swelling. They seem to have a component of the venom as well that affects your nasal, that whole system and that. So you get things like watery eyes and congestion, nasal congestion, hypersalivation and things like that. More like an allergic reaction than an actual envenomation. So they really are interesting snakes, but you don't see them that often.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Yeah, well, just you're still based in Ohio, is that correct?
As of the moment, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And do you have a lot of herps in your neck of the woods that you go out and?
It depends what you're looking for. Like Ohio's, in my opinion, one of the most underrated states, at least in terms of salamanders. That's pretty decent salamander diversity.
Yeah.
So, and we have one unique insular species. So, on to the north of Ohio is the Lake Erie, one really large freshwater lake, and we have these islands in the middle of it that has a subspecies of water snake. So it's a Lake Erie water snake, and it's only found on these little islands that are like a few miles offshore.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah,
but like I said, salamander diversity is pretty cool. So like we have a set of salamanders that are triploid. So they have a triploid chromosome count, and they're all females. But the thing is, they also seduce males of either their parent species, and the sperm doesn't usually fertilize it. The eggs, it actually just triggers the cloning process for those triploid females.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Wow, that's interesting in that. Well, the States is also very high up on my list of places to go. I've actually got a brother who's been living in California now for the better part of a decade.
Oh, California is a really great state to go, Herb.
Yeah, so he's just a little bit north of San Diego in San Clemente, and we're long overdue for a visit to that side. But I'm trying to coincide it to maximize the herping as well. One of my dreams is to really do a good rattlesnake tour. I'd like to almost do like a cross between the States, like start up in the Northeast, look for some timber rattlesnakes, then kind of go down to the Southwest and look at all the desert rattlesnakes, from your Western Diamondbacks to your the Sidewinders and the black-tailed rattlesnakes and all those really interesting things. And of course, the little unique ones that you find in the mountains, I think your ridge-nosed rattlesnakes and things like that. And then, of course, Florida is an absolute must for two reasons. I have an interest in invasive herps as well, in seeing how these things establish and why they establish in certain areas. So to go out and see Burmese pythons in the Everglades is, something big on my list. And then, of course, if I'm really lucky to see that iconic Eastern Diamondback rattlesnake in your palm sand, Florida sort of setting. And hopefully it won't be a small one. I really want to see a monster Eastern Diamondback. So yeah, I'll keep you updated on my moves on that front and also any of the trips that I do in Africa. And I think sometime in the future, if we do a trip, I'm slowly getting a little bit more into videography. So hopefully I can actually start doing more videos as well instead of just photographs.
Yeah.
And actually document some of these trips that I'm planning. And then between Africa and Europe, and of course North America, we should come across some pretty good things. And funny enough, yeah, in Portugal so far, I haven't really spent a lot of time herping. I've come across a couple of local little lizards and one or two amphibians, but I haven't really gone out there to see. Portugal's quite a few interesting snakes. So hopefully now that we a month or two away from spring, I can get back out into the field and start seeing, you know, what's moving around the neighborhood here in Portugal.
Yeah. I was going to say the Iberian countries. It's one. I'm not really interested in herping in Europe, but outside of Greece, the Iberian countries would be at the top of my list for herping in Europe.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like you said, California, that's a great place to go. I actually have a brother who lives in Northern California, so I've been out there a few times. Only found one rattlesnake out there, but I was gonna say, you did mention you did works with invasives, at least research interest wise. Does South Africa or any of the other African countries have any significant invasive herp species?
No, nothing established, nothing at the moment in that, but South Africa has got a massive hobbyist trade. So there's inevitable, you get a lot of escapees and stuff, but nothing has established to date. Barring what, only one potential one, and that's the red-eared slider terrapin.
Of course, it's the red-eared slider.
Yeah, that you find a lot of them in certain wetlands along the coastal regions, the eastern coastal regions, a couple of areas on the outskirts of Johannesburg, but there's nobody really doing a lot of research on invasive herps, so nobody knows the population density. They're not sure if they're breeding. We've got one or two photographic records where you can see a female is clearly nesting, and she's dug a hole and she's dropping some eggs into there. Are they fertile eggs? Is that population surviving? Those things we don't know. So we don't have any issues like you currently have in Florida. With herps and stuff, but also to the hobby, you know, when I say it's grown in the last 20 years in South Africa, it's nowhere near the size as you would find in Germany or the United States. And, you know, it's still relatively conserved.
Yeah. Well, that's good at least.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was going to say red-eared sliders might be the most invasive herp on the planet. It seems like.
I think they just trick so many people. You know, everybody gets them when they're small and they look cute. And I think
and then they get big and poop a lot.
Yeah, I think in the 1980s when the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle film came out, that just exploded the trade in turtles, and these things were just exported and went everywhere. And I know even here in Portugal and Spain, there's a couple of feral populations. You can hardly go anywhere where there's you know, red-eared sliders somewhere. And the same situation in South Africa. People just got tired of them. They got big. And when you've got something the size of a dinner plate and it smells quite bad, you know, people just drop them off in the local wetlands. And so now we've got a couple of them floating out there. But to what extent and how many, it's hard to say.
Yeah. I was going to say, if several species of freshwater turtle are driven to extinction because of red-eared sliders, this would be the craziest butterfly effect just from someone making a cartoon in the 80s about mutant turtles.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's true.
Butterfly effect is crazy.
Yeah.
All right. With that, how can people find your website to look at it? I'm looking at it right now. It's actually pretty cool looking.
Yeah, thank you. We still, I redid the website from scratch in June of last year, June, July, and we're still fine-tuning a couple of things in that. I'm going to be putting on a couple of really nice interactive courses on biodiversity. So anybody that wants to learn more about African biodiversity and some of the venomous snakes and things like that, there's going to be some really nice content going up onto the platform at some point. And I'm also putting up a whole bunch of resources. There's one or two little downloadable booklets that you can get off the site, but it's still a work in progress. I've got a lot of ideas for the website, and over the next month or so, I'm going to be doing putting a lot of time and effort into just streamlining it and getting it a little bit better. So yeah, they can go onto it. It's bioenviroafrica.com. Or if you just do a Google search, Biodiversity Environment Africa, it will pop up. And my contact details are there. So if anybody wants to find out more, or if they want to find out more about herping in Africa, they can let me know. One of the things I'm looking at doing as well is teaming up with the guys in Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, and Namibia to actually run a couple of herping tours. To go out there, do a bit of photography and go out and see some of the local herps and stuff like that. So that's something I'm working on towards the end of the year to hopefully start running a few of those excursions.
All right. Well, it looks like I might know where my next herp trip is in like 2027 or so.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. And I'll make sure to link the website in the episode's description details. So
excellent. Well, I've really enjoyed this, Nate, and good catching up. And I'm sure we can get to do this again sometime in the future. And what I'll do is I can, you know, next time around, we'll throw in a couple of images and photos. And
yeah,
you can see when, you know, back in the day when I still had a lot of hair and I was handling green mambas and stuff.
Sounds like a plan. All right. Excellent. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Have a good weekend.
You too.